I'm afraid I can't think so well when I take the medicine, he said. In fact, I think I'm getting on a lot better without it, don't you? It slows me down.
Igor took refuge in silence. In his experience, many of the world's greatest discoveries were made by men who would be considered mad by conventional standards. Insanity depended on your point of view, he always said, and if it was the view through your own underpants, then everything looked fine. But young Master Jeremy was beginning to worry him. He never laughed, and Igor liked a good maniacal laugh. You could trust it. Since giving up the medicine, Jeremy had not, as Igor had expected, begun to gibber and shout things like, "Mad! They say I was mad, but I shall show them all! Ah, ha, 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 ha!" He'd simply become more focused. Then there was that smile. Igor was not easily frightened, because otherwise he wouldn't be able to look in the mirror, but he was becoming a little troubled.
"Now, where were we?" said Jeremy. "Oh, yes. Give me a hand here."
Together they moved the table aside. Under it, dozens of glass jars hissed.
"Not enough power," said Igor. "Also, we have not got the mirrors right yet, sir."
Jeremy pulled the cloth off the device on the workbench. Glass and crystal glittered, and in some cases glittered very strangely. As Jeremy had remarked yesterday, in the clarity that was returning now that he was carefully pouring one spoonful of his medicine down the sink twice a day, some of the angles looked wrong. One crystal had disappeared when he'd locked it into place, but it was clearly still there because he could see the light reflecting off it.
"And we've still got too much metal in it, sir," Igor grumbled. "It was the spring that did for the last one."
"We will find a way," said Jeremy.
"Oh, made lightning, it's never as good as the real thought," said Igor.
"Good enough to test the principle," said Jeremy.
"Test the principle," muttered Igor. "Sorry, sir, but eagles do not test the principle. Strap it to the bench and put a good thick bolt of lightning. That's our motto. That's how you test something."
"You seem ill at ease, Igor."
"Well, I'm sorry, sir," said Igor. "It's the climate disagreeing with me. I'm used to regular thunderstorms."
"I've heard that some people really seem to come alive in thunderstorms," said Jeremy, carefully adjusting the angle of a crystal.
"Ah, that was when I worked for Baron Finkelstein," said Igor.
Jeremy stood back. This wasn't the clock, of course. There was still a lot more work to do, but he could see it in front of him if he closed his eyes, before they had a clock. This was just an essay, to see if he was on the right line. He was on the right line. He knew it.
Susan walked back through the motionless streets, sat down in Madame Frout's office, and let herself sink back into the stream of time. She had never found out how this worked. It just did. Time didn't stop for the rest of the world, and it didn't stop for her. It was just that she entered a kind of loop of time, and everything else stayed exactly as it was until she'd finished what she needed to do. It was another inherited family trait. It worked best if you didn't think about it, just like tightrope walking. Anyway, now she had other things to think about. Madame Frout turned her gaze back from the rat-free mantelpiece. "Oh," she said, "it seems to have gone." "It was probably a trick of the light, madam," said Susan. "Mostly mortal. Someone like me," she thought.
Of course."
Madame Frout managed to get her glasses on, despite the fact that the string was still tangled with the button. It meant that she'd moored herself to her own chest, but she was damned if she was going to do anything about it now. Susan could unnerve a glacier. All she had to do was sit quietly, looking polite and alert. "What precisely was it you wanted, madam?" she said. "It's only that I've left the class doing algebra, and they get restless when they've finished."
"Algebra," said Madame Frout,
perforce staring at her own bosom, which no one else had ever done.
"But that's far too difficult for 7-year-olds."
"Yes, but I didn't tell them that, and so far they haven't found out," said Susan. It was time to move things along.
"I expect you wanted to see me about my letter, madam," she said.
Madame Frout looked blank.
"Well,"
she began. Susan sighed and snapped her fingers. She walked around and opened a drawer by the motionless Madame Frout, removed a sheet of paper, and spent some time carefully writing a letter. She let the ink dry, rustled the paper a bit to make it look slightly second-hand, and then put it just under the top of the pile of paperwork beside Madame Frout, with enough of it peeking out so that it would be easy to see. She returned to her seat. She snapped her fingers again.
"What letter?" said Madame Frout.
And then she looked down at her desk.
"Oh."
It was a cruel thing to do, Susan knew. But while Madame Frout was not by any means a bad person, and was quite kind to children, in a haphazard way, she was silly. And Susan did not have a lot of time for silly.
"Yes, I asked if I might have a few days' leave," said Susan. "Pressing family matters, I am afraid. I have prepared some work for the children to get on with, of course."
Madame Frout hesitated. Susan didn't have time for this, either. She snapped her fingers.
"My goodness, that'd be a relief,"
she said in a voice whose harmonics went all the way into the subconscious.
"If we don't slow her down, we'll run out of things to teach them. She has been performing small miracles on a daily basis and deserves a raise."
Then she sat back, snapped her fingers again, and watched the words settle into the forefront of Madame Frout's mind. The woman's lips actually moved.
Why, yes, of course," she murmured at last. "You have been working very hard, and
there are some things even a voice of eldritch command can't achieve, and one of them is to get extra money out of a head teacher.
We shall have to think about a little increment for you one of these days."
Susan returned to the classroom and spent the rest of the day performing small miracles, which included removing the glue from Richenda's hair, emptying the wee out of Billy's shoes, and treating the class to a short visit to the continent of Forex. When the parents came to pick them up, they were all waving crayoned pictures of kangaroos, and Susan had to hope that the red dust on their shoes, red mud in the case of Billy's, whose sense of timing had not improved, would pass unnoticed. It probably would. Fidgets was not the only place where adults didn't see what couldn't possibly be true. Now she sat back. There was something pleasant about an empty classroom. Of course, as any teacher would point out, one nice thing was that there were no children in it, and particularly no Jason. But the tables and shelves around the room showed evidence of a term well spent. Paintings lined the walls and showed good use of perspective and color. The class had built a full-sized white horse cut out of cardboard, during which time they'd learned a lot about horses, and Susan learned about Jason's remarkably accurate powers of observation. She'd had to take the cardboard tube away from him and explain that this was a polite horse. It had been a long day. She raised the lid of her desk and took out Grimm Fairy Tales. This dislodged some paperwork, which in turn revealed a small cardboard box decorated in black and gold. It had been a little present from Vincent's parents. She stared at the box. Every day she had to go through this. It was ridiculous. It wasn't even as if Higgs and Meekins did good chocolates. They were just butter and sugar and... She scrabbled among the sad little scraps of brown paper inside the box and pulled out a chocolate. No one could be expected not to have just one chocolate after all. She put it in her mouth. Damn, 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 damn! It was nougat inside. Her one chocolate today. And it was damn artificial, damn pink and white, damn sickly, damn stupid nougat. Well, no one could be expected to believe that counted.
This is true. A chocolate you did not want to eat does not count as chocolate. This discovery is from the same branch of culinary physics that determined that food eaten while walking along contains no calories.
She was entitled to another. The teacher part of her, which had eyes in the back of its head, caught the blur of movement. She spun around. No running with scythes. The death of rats stopped jogging along the nature table and gave her a guilty look. Squeak? And no going into the stationery cupboard either, said Susan automatically. She slammed the desk lid shut. Squeak! Yes, you were. I could hear you thinking about it. It was possible to deal with the death of rats, provided you thought of him as a very small Jason. The stationery cupboard. That was one of the great battlegrounds of classroom history. That and the playhouse. But the ownership of the playhouse usually sorted itself out without Susan's intervention, so that all she had to do was be ready with ointment, a nose blow, and mild sympathy for the losers. Whereas the stationery cupboard was a war of attrition. It contained pots of powdered paint, and reams of paper, and boxes of crayons, and more idiosyncratic items like a spare pair of pants for Billy, who did his best. It also contained the scissors, which under classroom rules were treated as some kind of doomsday machine. And of course, the boxes of stars. The only people allowed in the cupboard were Susan and, usually, Vincent. Despite everything Susan had tried, short of actual deception, he was always the official best at everything, and won the coveted honor every day, which was to go into the stationery cupboard and fetch the pencils and hand them out. For the rest of the class, and especially Jason, the stationery cupboard was some mystic magic realm to be entered whenever possible. Honestly, thought Susan, once you learn the arts of defending the stationery cupboard, outwitting Jason, and keeping the class pet alive until the end of term, you've mastered at least half of teaching. She signed the register, watered the sad plants on the windowsill, went and fetched some fresh privet from the hedge for the stick insects that were the successors to Henry the Hamster, chosen on the basis that it was quite hard to tell when they were dead, tidied a few errant crayons away, and looked around the classroom at all those little chairs. It sometimes worried her that nearly everyone she knew well was 3 feet high. She was never certain that she trusted her grandfather at times like this. It was all to do with the rules. He couldn't interfere, but he knew her weaknesses, and he could wind her up and send her out into the world. Someone like me. Yes, he'd known how to engage her interest. Someone like me. Suddenly there's some dangerous clock somewhere in the world, and suddenly I'm told that there's someone like me. Someone like me. Except not like me. At least I knew my parents. And she'd listened to Death's account of the tall, dark woman wandering from room to room in the endless castle of glass, weeping for the child she'd given birth to, and could see every day, but could never touch. Where do I even begin?
Lopsang learned a lot. He learned that every room had at least 4 corners, He learned of the sweepers, started work when the sky was light enough to see the dust, and continued until sunset. As a master, Lutzer was kind enough. He would always point out those bits that Lobsang had not done properly. After the initial anger and the taunting of his former classmates, Lobsang found that the work had a certain charm. Days drifted past under his broom. Until, almost with an audible click in his brain, he decided that enough was enough. He finished his section of passageway and found Lutzer dreamily pushing his brush along a terrace. "Sweeper?" "Yes, lad." "What is it you are trying to tell me?" "I'm sorry?" "I didn't expect to become a sweeper. You're Lutzer. I expected to be apprenticed to, well, to the hero."
"You did?" Lutzer scratched his beard. "Oh, dear. Damn. Yes, I can see the problem. Well, you should have sent. Why didn't you say? I don't really do that sort of thing anymore."
"You don't?
Oh, all that playing with history. Running about, unsettling people. No, not really. I was never quite certain that we should be doing it, to be honest. No, sweeping's good enough for me. There's something real about a nice clean floor."
"This is a test, isn't it?" said Lobsang coldly.
"Oh, yes.
I mean, I understand how it works. The master makes the pupil do all the menial jobs, and then it turns out that really the pupil is learning things of great value. And I don't think I'm learning anything, really, except that people are pretty messy and inconsiderate."
"Well, not a bad lesson all the same," said Lutzer. "Is it not written, 'Hard work never did anybody any harm'?"
"Where is it written, Lutzer?" said Lobsang, thoroughly exasperated. The sweeper brightened up.
"Ah," he said, "perhaps the pupil is ready to learn. Then you don't wish to know the way of the sweeper? You wish to learn instead the way of Mrs. Cosmopolite?"
"Who?"
"We have swept well. Let's go to the gardens. For is it not written, it does you good to get out in the fresh air?"
"Is it?" said Lobsang, still bewildered. Lutzer pulled a small tattered notebook out of his pocket.
"In here it is," he said. "I should know."
Lutzer patiently adjusted a tiny mirror to redirect sunlight more favorably on one of the bonsai mountains. He hummed tunelessly under his breath. Lobsang, sitting cross-legged on the stones, carefully turned the yellowing pages of the ancient notebook, on which was written in faded ink, "The Way of Mrs. Cosmopolite."
"Well?" said Lutzer.
"The way has an answer for everything, does it?"
"Yes."
"Then," Lobsang nodded at the little volcano, which was gently smoking, "how does that work? It's on a saucer." Lutzer stared straight ahead, his lips moving.
"Page 76, I think," he said.
Lobsang turned to the page. "Because," he read.
"Good answer,"
said Lutzer, gently caressing a minute crag with a camel hair brush.
"Just because, master? No reason?"
"Reason?
What reason can a mountain have? And as you accumulate years, you will learn that most answers boil down eventually to because."
Lobsang said nothing. The Book of the Way was giving him problems. What he wanted to say was this: "Lutzer, this reads like a book of the sayings of an old lady. It's the sort of thing old ladies say. What kind of koan is, 'It won't get better if you picket it,' or 'Eat it up, it'll make your hair curly,' or 'Everything comes to he who waits'? This is the stuff you get in Hogswatch crackers."
"Really?"
said Lutzer, still apparently engrossed in a mountain. "I didn't say anything."
"Oh, I thought you did.
Do you miss Ankh-Morpork?"
"Yes,
I didn't have to sweep floors there."
"Were you a good thief?"
"I was a fantastic thief." A breeze blew a scent of cherry blossom.
Just once, thought Lutzer, it'd have been nice to pick cherries.
"I've been to Ankh-Morpork," he said, straightening up and moving on to the next mountain.
"You've seen the visitors we get here."
"Yes," said Lobsang. "Everyone laughs at them."
"Really?" Blutzer raised his eyebrows. When they have trekked thousands of miles seeking the truth?
But did not Wen say that if the truth is anywhere, it is everywhere? Said Lobsang.
Well done! I see you've learned something at least. But one day it seemed to me that everyone else had decided that wisdom can only be found a long way off. So I went to Ankh-Morpork. They were all coming here, so it seemed only fair.
Seeking enlightenment?
No, the wise man does not seek enlightenment, he waits for it. So, while I was waiting, it occurred to me that seeking perplexity might be more fun, said Lutzer. After all, enlightenment begins where perplexity ends. And I found perplexity. And a kind of enlightenment, too. I had not been there 5 minutes, for example, when some men in an alley tried to enlighten me of what little I possessed, giving me a valuable lesson in the ridiculousness of material things.
But why Ankh-Morpork? Said Lobsang.
Look in the back of the book, said Lutzer.
There was a yellow, crackling scrap of paper tucked in there. The boy unfolded it.
Oh, this is just a bit of the almanac, he said. It's very popular there.
Yes, a seeker after wisdom left it here.
It's just got the phases of the moon on this page.
Other side, said the sweeper.
Lobsang turned the paper over.
But it's just an advert from the Ankh-Morpork Guild of Merchants, said Lobsang. Ankh-Morpork has everything.
He stared at the smiling Lutzer.
And you thought that...
Ah, I am old and simple, and understand, said the sweeper, whereas you are young and complicated. Didn't Wen see portents in the swirl of gruel in his bowl, and the flight of birds? This was actually written. I mean, flights of birds are quite complex, but these were words, and I saw the opening of the way, my way.
And you went all the way to Ankh-Morpork, said Lobsang weakly,
and I fetched up calm of mind but empty of pocket in Quirm Street, said the sweeper, smiling serenely at the recollection, and I espied a sign in a window saying, Rooms to Rent. Thus I met Mrs. Cosmopolite, who opened the door when I knocked, and then, when I hesitated, not being sure of the language, she said, I haven't got all day, you know, almost to a word, one of the sayings of Wen. Instantly, I knew that I'd found what I was seeking. During the days, I washed dishes in an eating house for 20 pence a day and all the scraps I could take away, and in the evenings, I helped Mrs. Cosmopolite clean the house and listened carefully to her conversation. She was a natural sweeper with a good rhythmical motion and a bottomless wisdom. Within the first 2 days she uttered to me the actual words said by Wen upon understanding the true nature of time. It was when I asked for a reduced rate because, of course, I did not sleep in a bed, and she said, I was not born yesterday, Mr. Zer. Astonishing. And she could never have seen the sacred text.
Lobsang's face was a carefully drawn picture.
I was not born yesterday, he said.
Ah, yes, of course, as a novice you would not have got that far, said Lutzer. It was when he fell asleep in a cave, and in a dream saw time appear to him and show him that the universe is recreated from second to second, endlessly. And he stepped out from the cave into the truly new world and said, I was not born yesterday.
Oh, yes, said Lobsang, but...
Ah, Mrs. Cosmopolite, said Lutzer, his eyes misting over. What a woman for keeping things clean. If she was a sweeper here, no one would be allowed to walk on the floor. Her house so amazing, a palace. New sheets every other week, and cook! Just to taste her beans baked upon the toast, a man would give up a cycle of the universe.
Said Lobsang.
I stayed for 3 months, sweeping her house as is fitting for the pupil, and then I returned here, my way clear before me.
And these stories about you?
Oh, all true. Well, most of them. A bit of exaggeration, but mostly true.
Well, the one about the citadel in Muntab, and the Pash, and the fishbone?
Oh, yes.
But how did you get in where half a dozen trained and armed men couldn't even... I'm a little man and I carry a broom, said Lutza simply. Everyone has some mess that needs clearing up. What harm is a man with a broom? What? And that was it? Well, the rest was a matter of cookery, really. The Bash was not a good man, but he was a glutton for his fish pie. No martial arts, said Lopsang. Oh, always as a last resort. History needs shepherds, not butchers. Do you know Okidoki? Just a lot of bunny hops. Shiitake? Very fast, he said. He leaned down and blew the petals away from a tiny glacier. You slice time as fast as a tenth gym, and as yet barely trained. You must have been a great thief. And now, oh dear, I shall have to face you in the dojo. No, there's no need, said Lobsang, because now Lutza looked frightened and humiliated and somehow small and brittle-boned. Oh, I insist, said the old man. Let us get it done now, for it is written, there is no time like the present, which is Mrs. Cosmopolite's most profound understanding. He sighed and looked up at the giant statue of Wen. Look at him, he said. He was a lad, eh? Completely blissed out on the universe. Saw the past and the future as one living person, and wrote the books of history to tell how the story should go. We can't imagine what those eyes saw, and he never raised a hand to any man in his life. Look, I really didn't want to. And you've looked at the other statues? Said Lutza, as if he'd completely forgotten about the dojo. Distractedly, Lobsang followed his gaze. Up on the raised stone platform that ran the whole length of the garden were hundreds of smaller statues, mostly carved of wood, all of them painted in garish colours. Figures with more eyes than legs, more tails than teeth. Monstrous amalgamations of fish and squid and tiger and parsnip. Things put together as if the creator of the universe had tipped out his box of spare parts and stuck them together. Things painted pink and orange and purple and gold looked down over the valley. Oh, the Dlang, Lobsang began. Demons? Well, that's one word for them, said the sweeper. The abbot called them the enemies of mind. Wen wrote a scroll about them, you know, and he said that was the worst. He pointed to a little hooded grey shape, which looked out of place among the festival of wild extremities. It doesn't look very dangerous, said Lobsang. Look, sweeper, I don't want to... They can be very dangerous, things that don't look dangerous, said Lutza. Not looking dangerous is what makes them dangerous, for it is written, you can't tell a book by its cover. Lutza, I really don't want to fight you. Oh, your tutors will tell you that the discipline of a martial art enables you to slice time, and that's true as far as it goes, said Lutza, apparently not listening. But so can sweeping. That's perhaps you've found. Always find the perfect moment, Wen said. People just seem so keen on using it to kick other people on the back of the neck. Oh, but it wasn't a challenge. I just wanted you to show me, and I shall. Come on, I made a bargain. I must keep it, old fool that I am. The nearest dojo was the dojo of the tenth gym. It was empty, except for two monks blurring as they danced across the mat and wrapped time around themselves. Lutza had been right, Lobsang knew. Time was a resource. You could learn to let it move fast or slow, so that a monk could walk easily through a crowd and yet be moving so fast that no one could see him. Or he could stand still for a few seconds and watch the sun and moon chase one another across a flickering sky. He could meditate for a day in a minute. Here, in the valley, a day lasted forever. The blurred fighters became a couple of hesitant monks when they saw Lutza. He bowed. I beg the use of this dojo for a short period while my apprentice teaches me the folly of old age, he said. Look, I really didn't mean... Lobsang began, but Lutza elbowed him in the ribs. The monks gave the old man a nervous look. It's yours, Lutza, said one of them. They hurried out, almost tripping over their own feet as they kept looking back. Time and its control is what we should teach here, said Lutza, watching them go. The martial arts are an aid. That is all they are.
At least, that's all they were meant to be. Even out in the world, a well-trained person may perceive in the fray how flexible time may be. Here, we can build on that. Compress time, stretch time, hold a moment. Punching people's kidneys out through their nose is only a foolish byproduct. Lutzer took down a razor-edged pika sword from the rack and handed it to the shop boy. You've seen one of these before? They're not really for novices, but you show promise. Well, yes, sweeper, but know how to use it? Well, I'm good at the practice ones, but they're just made of... Take it, then, and attack me. There was a rustling noise above them. Lopsang looked up and saw monks pouring into the observation gallery above the dojo. There were some very senior ones among them. News gets around quickly in a little world. Rule 2, said Lutzer, is never refuse a weapon. He took a few steps back. In your own time, boy. Lopsang wielded the curved sword uncertainly. Well, said Lutzer, I can't just... Is this the dojo of the 10th gym? Said Lutzer. Why, mercy me, I do believe it is. That means there are no rules, doesn't it? Any weapon, any strategy, anything is allowed. Do you understand? Are you stupid? But I can't kill someone just because they've asked me to. Why not? What happened to Mr. Manners? But you are holding a deadly weapon. You are facing an unarmed man in a pose of submission. Are you frightened? Yes, yes, I am. Good. That's rule 3, said Lutzer quietly. See how much you're learning already? Wipe the smile off your face, have I? All right, put the sword on the rack and take a dagger stick. The most you can do with that is bruise my old bones. Look, I would prefer it if you wore the protective padding. Oh, you're that good with a stick, are you? I'm very fast. Then, if you don't fight right now, I shall wrest it from you and break it over your head, said Lutzer, drawing back. Ready? The only defense is to attack well, I'm told. Lopsang raised the stick in reluctant salute. Lutzer folded his hands, and, as Lopsang danced toward him, closed his eyes and smiled to himself. Lopsang raised the stick, and hesitated. Lutzer was grinning. Rule 2. Rule 3. What had been rule 1? Always remember rule 1. Lutzer! The abbot's chief acolyte arrived panting in the doorway, waving urgently. Lutzer opened one eye, and then the other one, and then winked at Lopsang. Narrow escape there, eh? He said. He turned to the acolyte. Yes, exalted sir. You must come immediately. And all monks who are cleared for a tour in the world, to the Mandala Hall, now! There was a scuffling in the gallery, and several monks pushed their way out through the crowd. Ah, excitement, said Lutzer, taking the stick from Lopsang's unresisting hands and putting it back into the rack. The hall was emptying fast. Around the whole of Oidong, gongs were being banged frantically. What's happening? Said Lopsang, as the last of the monks surged past. I dare say we shall soon be told, said Lutzer, starting to roll himself a cigarette. Well, hadn't we better hurry? Everyone's going. The sound of flapping sandals died away in the distance. Well, nothing seems to be on fire, said Lutzer calmly. Besides, if we wait a little, then by the time we get there, everyone will have stopped shouting and perhaps they will be making some sense. Let us take the clock path. The display is particularly fine at this time of day. But, it is written, you've got to learn to walk before you can run, said Lutzer, putting his broom over his shoulder. Mrs. Cosmopolite again? Amazing woman. Dusted like a demon, too. The clock path wound out from the main complex, up through the terraced gardens, and then rejoined the wider path as it tunnelled into the cliff wall. Novices always asked why it was called the clock path, since there was no sign of a clock anywhere. More gongs started to bang, but they were muffled by the greenery. Lopsang heard more running feet up on the main path. Down here, hummingbirds flickered from flower to flower, oblivious to any excitement. I wonder what time it is,
said Lutzer, who was walking ahead. Everything is a test. Lobsang glanced around at the flower bed. 9:15, he said.
Oh? And how did you know that?
The field marigold is open, the red sandwort is opening, the purple bindweed is closed, and the yellow goat's beard is closing, said Lobsang.
You worked out the floral clock all by yourself?
Oh, yes, it's obvious.
Really? What time is it when the white water lily opens?
6 in the morning.
You came to look?
Yes. You planted this garden, did you?
One of my little efforts.
It's beautiful.
Well, it's not very accurate in the small hours. There aren't too many night-blooming plants that grow well up here. They open for the moths, you know.
It's how time wants to be measured, said Lobsang.
Really? Of course, I'm not an expert, said Lutzer.
He pinched out the end of his cigarette and stuck it behind his ear.
If I wanted to thrust my hand into hot sand, I would go to the seaside.
Upsy-daisy?
Waste of good bricks.
No can do.
You made that one up.
Tung pea?
Bad-tempered flower arranging.
Deja vu? That got a reaction. Lutzer's eyebrows raised.
Deja vu? You heard that rumor? Time as a weapon? He said. Ha! None of the monks here knows deja vu. I'd soon hear about it if they did. Look, boy, violence is the resort of the violent. In most tight corners, a broomstick suffices.
Only most, eh? Said Lobsang, not trying to hide the sarcasm.
Oh, I see. You wish to face me in the dojo? For it's a very old truth. When the pupil can beat the master, there is nothing the master cannot tell him because the apprenticeship is ended. You want to learn? Ah, I knew there was something to learn.
Lutzer stood up.
Why you? He said. Why here? Why now? There is a time and a place for everything. Why this time and this place? If I take you to the dojo, you will return what you stole from me. Now!
He looked down at the teak table where he worked on his fountains. The little shovel was there. A few cherry blossom petals fluttered to the ground.
I see, he said. You are that fast? I did not see you.
Lobsang said nothing.
It is a small and worthless thing, said Lutzer. Why did you take it, please?
To see if I could. I was bored.
Ah, we shall see if we can make life more interesting for you, then. No wonder you are bored when you can already slice time like that.
Lutzer turned the little shovel over and over in his hand.
Oh, well, let's keep going. Everyone may have stopped arguing at cross purposes by now. How do you feel about going through the mandala hall again?
Oh, I'll be fine. I'd just forgotten about it, that's all.
Really? And you'd never seen it before, too, but time plays funny tricks on us all. Why, I once...
Lutzer stopped and stared at the apprentice.
You're right, he said. You've gone pale.
Lobsang grimaced and shook his head.
Something felt odd, he said.
He vaguely waved a hand in the direction of the lowlands, spread out in a blue and grey pattern on the horizon.
Something... over there.
The glass clock. The great glass house, and here, where it shouldn't be, the glass clock. It was barely here. It showed up as shimmering lines in the air, as if it was possible to capture the sparkle of light off a shiny surface without the surface itself. Everything here was transparent. Delicate chairs, tables, vases of flowers. And now he realized that glass was not a word to use here. Crystal might be better, or ice. The thin, flawless ice you sometimes got after a sharp frost. Everything was visible only by its edges. He could make out staircases through distant walls. Above and below and to every side, the glass rooms went on forever. And yet, it was all familiar. It felt like home. Sound filled the glass rooms. It streamed away in clear, sharp notes, like the tones made by a wet finger around a wine glass rim. There was movement, too. A haze in the air beyond the transparent walls, shifting and wavering and watching him.
How can it come from over there? And how do you mean odd?
Said the voice of Lutzer. Lobsang blinked.
This was the odd place.
The one right here. The rigid and unbending world. And then the feeling passed and faded.
Just odd, for a moment,
he mumbled. There was dampness on his cheek. He raised his hand and touched wetness.
It's that rancid yak butter they put in the tea. I've always said so, said Lutzer. Mrs. Cosmopolite, never. Now, that is unusual, he said, looking up.
What? What? Said Lobsang, looking blankly at his wet fingertips, and then up at the cloudless sky.
A procrastinator going over speed.
He shifted position.
Can you feel it?
I can't hear anything, said Lobsang.
Not hear, feel. Coming up through your sandals. Oops, there goes another one. And another one. You can't feel it. That's old 66. They've never got it properly balanced. We'll hear them in a minute. Oh, dear, look at the flowers. Do, look at the flowers.
Lobsang turned. The ice plants were opening. The field south thistle was closing.
Time leak, said Lutzer. Hark at that. You can hear them now, eh? They're dumping time randomly. Come on!
According to the second scroll of When the Eternally Surprised, When the Eternally Surprised sawed the first procrastinator from the trunk of a wham-wham tree, carved certain symbols on it, fitted it with a bronze spindle, and summoned the apprentice, Claudepool.
Ah, very nice, master, said Claudepool. A prayer wheel, yes?
No, this is nothing like as complex, said Wen. It merely stores and moves time.
That's simple, eh?
And now? I shall test it, said Wen. He gave it a half turn with his hand.
Ah, very nice, master, said Claudepool. A prayer wheel, yes?
No, this is nothing like as complex, said Wen. It merely stores and moves time.
That's simple, eh?
And now I shall test it, said Wen. He moved it a little less this time.
That's simple, eh?
And now I shall test it, said Wen. This time he twisted it gently to and fro.
That's simple, eh?
Said Claudepool. And I have tested it, said Wen.
It worked, master?
Yes, I think so. Wen stood up. Give me the rope that you used to carry the firewood, and, yes, a pit from one of those cherries that you picked yesterday. He wound the frayed rope around the cylinder and tossed the pit onto a patch of mud. Claudepool jumped out of the way. See those mountains, said Wen, tugging the rope. The cylinder spun and balanced there, humming gently.
Oh, yes, master, said Claudepool obediently.
There was practically nothing up here but mountains. There were so many that sometimes they were impossible to see because they got in the way. How much time does stone need, said Wen. Or the deep sea. We shall move it, he placed his left hand just above the spinning blur, to where it is needed. He looked down at the cherry pit. His lips moved silently, as though he was working through some complex puzzle. Then he pointed his right hand at the pit. Stand back, he said, and gently let a finger touch the cylinder. There was no sound except the crack of the air as it moved aside, and a hiss of steam from the mud. Wen looked up at the new tree and smiled.
I did say you should stand back, he said.
I shall get down now, then, shall I? Said a voice among the blossom-laden branches.
But carefully, said Wen, and sighed as Claudepool crashed down in a shower of petals.
There will always be cherry blossom here, he said.
Lutzer hitched up his robe and scurried back down the path. Lobsang ran after him. A high-pitched whine seemed to be coming out of the rocks themselves. The sweeper skidded at the carp pond, now erupting in strange waves, and headed down a shady track alongside a stream. Red ibises erupted into flight. He stopped and threw himself flat on the paving slabs. "Get down, now!" But Lobsang was already headlong. He heard something pass overhead with a plangent sound. He looked back and saw the last ibis tumbling in the air, shedding feathers and shrinking as it flew. It squawked and vanished with a pop. Not vanished entirely. An egg followed the same trajectory for a few seconds and then smashed on the stones.
"Random time! Come on, come on!" shouted Lutzer.
He scrambled to his feet again, headed towards an ornamental grill in the cliff face ahead of them, and with surprising strength, wrenched it out of the wall.
"It's a bit of a drop, but if you roll when you land, you'll be okay,"
he said, lowering himself into the hole.
"Where does it go?" "Well, the procrastinators, of course."
"But novices aren't allowed in there under pain of death."
"Well, that's a coincidence," said Lutzer, lowering himself to the tips of his fingers, "because death is what awaits you if you stay out there, too."
He dropped into the darkness. A moment later, there was an unenlightened curse from below. Lobsang climbed in, hung by his fingertips, dropped and rolled when he hit the floor below.
"Well done," said Lutzer in the gloom. "When in doubt, choose to live. This way."
The passageway opened into a wide corridor. The noise here was shattering. Something mechanical was in agony. There was a crump, and a few moments after, a babble of voices. Several dozen monks, wearing thick cork hats as well as their traditional robes, came running around the corner. Most of them were yelling. A few of the brighter ones were saving their breath in order to cover the ground more quickly. Lutzer grabbed one of them, who tried to struggle free.
"Let me go! What's happening? Just get out of here before they all go!"
The monk shook himself free and sped after the rest of them. Lutzer bent down, picked up a fallen cork helmet, and solemnly handed it to Lobsang.
"Health and safety at work," he said. "Very important."
"Will it protect me?"
said Lobsang, putting it on.
"Not really. But when they find your head, it may be recognizable. When we get into the hall, don't touch anything."
Lobsang had been expecting some vaulted, magnificent structure. People talked about the Procrastinator Hall as if it was some kind of huge cathedral. But what there was at the end of the passage was a haze of blue smoke. It was only when his eyes got accustomed to the swirling gloom that he saw the nearest cylinder. It was a squat pillar of rock, about 3 yards across and 6 yards high. It was spinning so fast that it was a blur. Around it, the air flickered with slivers of silver-blue light.
"See? They're dumping! Over here, quick!"
He ran after Lutzer, and saw there were hundreds, no, thousands of cylinders, some of them reaching all the way to the cavern roof. There were still monks in here. Some of them were running to and from the wells with buckets of water, which flashed into steam when they threw it over the smoking stone bearings at the base of the cylinders.
"Idiots," the sweeper muttered.
He cupped his hands and shouted,
"Where is the overseer?"
Lobsang pointed down to the edge of a wooden podium built onto the wall of the hall. There was a rotting cork hat there, and a pair of ancient sandals, and in between was a pile of grey dust.
"Poor fellow," said Lutzer. "A full 50,000 years in one jolt, I'd say."
He glared at the scurrying monks again.
"Will you lot stop and come here? I ain't going to ask you twice."
Several of them swept the sweat out of their eyes and trotted toward the podium, relieved to hear any kind of order, while behind them the procrastinators screamed.
"Right," said Lutzer, as they were joined by more and more. "Now, listen to me. This is just a surge cascade. You've all heard of them. We can deal with it. We just have to cross-link futures and pasts, fastest ones first."
"Poor Mr. Schoblang already tried that,"
said a monk. He nodded at the sad pile.
"Then I want two teams."
Lutzer stopped.
"No, we haven't got time. We'll do it by the soles of our feet, like we used to. One man to a spinner, just smack the bars when I say. Ready to go when I call the numbers."
Lutzer climbed onto the podium and ran his eye over a board covered with wooden bobbins. A red or blue nimbus hovered over each one.
"What a mess," he said. "What a mess!"
"What do they mean?" said Lobsang. Lutzer's hands hovered over the bobbins.
"Okay, the red-tinted ones are winding time out, speeding it up," he said. "The blue-tinted ones, they're winding time in, slowing it down. Brightness of the color, that's how fast they're doing it. Except that now they're all freewheeling, because the surge cut them loose, understand?"
"We're loose from what?"
"From the load, from the world. See, up there?"
He waved a hand toward two long racks that ran all the way along the cavern wall. Each one held a row of swiveling shutters, one line blue, one line dark red.
"The more shutters showing a colour, the more time winding or unwinding?"
"Good lad. Got to keep it balanced. And the way we get through this is we couple the spinners up in twos so that they wind and unwind one another. Cancel themselves out. Poor old Schoblang was trying to put them back into service, I reckon. Can't be done. Not during a cascade. You've got to let it fall over and then pick up the pieces when it's nice and quiet."
He glanced at the bobbins and then at the crowd of monks.
"Right, you! 100 to 17, and then 45 to 89. Off you go! And you! 596 to, let's see, yes, 402. 790,
shouted Lobsang, pointing to a bobbin.
"You what? 790? Don't be daft! That's still unwinding, lad. 402 is our man right here.
790 is about to start winding time again.
It's still bright blue.
It's going to unwind, I know it, because..."
The novice's finger moved over the lines of bobbins, hesitated, and pointed to a bobbin on the other side of the board.
"It's matching speeds with this one."
Lutzer appeared.
"It is written, well, I'll go to the foot of our stairs," he said. "They're forming a natural inversion."
He squinted at Lobsang.
"You're not the reincarnation of someone, are you? That happens a lot in these parts."
"Well, I don't think so. It's just obvious."
"A moment ago you didn't know anything about these."
"Yes, yes, but when you see them, it's obvious."
"Is it? Is it? All right, then the board's yours, Wonder Boy."
Lutzer stood back.
"Mine? But I..."
"Get on with it. That is an order."
For a moment, there was a suggestion of blue light around Lobsang. Lutzer wondered how much time he'd folded around himself in that second. Time enough to think, certainly. Then the boy called out half a dozen pairs of numbers. Lutzer turned to the monks.
"Jump to it, boys! Mr. Lobsang has the board. You boys just watch those bearings."
"But he's a novice!"
One of the monks began and stopped and backed away when he saw Lutzer's expression.
"All right, sweeper, all right."
A moment later, there was the sound of jumpers slamming into place. Lobsang called out another set of numbers. While the monks dashed to and fro to the butter bits for grease, Lutzer looked up at the nearest column. It was still spinning fast, but he was sure he could see the carvings. Lobsang ran his eye over the board again and stared up at the rumbling cylinders and then back to the lines of shutters. There wasn't anything written down about all this, Lutzer knew. You couldn't teach it in a classroom, although they tried. A good spin driver learned it through the soles of his feet, for all the theory that they taught you these days. He'd learn to feel the flows, to see the rows of procrastinators as wells or fountains of time. Old Schoblang had been so good that he'd been able to pull a couple of hours of wasted time off a classroom of bored pupils without them even noticing, and dump it into a busy workshop 1,000 miles away, as neat as you please. And then there was that trick he used to do with an apple to amaze the apprentices. He'd put it on a pillar next to them, and then flick time at it off one of the small spindles. In an instant, it'd be a collection of small, spindly trees before crumbling to dust. "That's what'll happen to you if you get things wrong," he'd said. Lutzer glanced down at the piles of grey dust under the disintegrating hat as he hurried past. Well, maybe it was the way he'd want to go. A scream of tormented stone made him look up.
Keep those bearings greased, you lazy devils!" he yelled, running on down the rows. "And watch those rails! Hands off the splines! We're doing fine!"
As he ran, he kept his eyes on the columns. They weren't turning randomly now. Now they had purpose.
"I think you're winning, lad,"
he shouted to the figure on the podium.
"Yes, but I can't balance it. There's too much time wound up and nowhere to put it." "How much?" "Almost 40 years.
Lutzer glanced at the shutters. 40 years looked about right, but surely...
"How much?"
he said.
40. "I'm sorry, there's nothing to take it up." "No problem. Steal it. Shed load. You can always put it back later. Dump it." "Where to?" "Find a big patch of sea."
The sweeper pointed to a crude map of the world painted on the wall.
"Do you know how to? Can you see how to give it the right spin and direction?"
Once again, there was the blueness in the air.
"Yes, I think so." "Yes, I imagine you do. In your own time, then."
Lutzer shook his head. 40 years? He was worried about 40 years? 40 years was nothing. Apprentice drivers had dumped 50,000 years before now. That was the thing about the sea. It just stayed big and wet. It always had been big and wet. It always would be big and wet. Oh, maybe fishermen would start to dredge up strange, whiskery fish that they'd only ever seen before as fossils, but who cared what happened to a bunch of codfish? The sound changed.
"What are you doing?" "Oh, I found space on number 422. It can take another 40 years. No sense in wasting time. I'm pulling it back now."
There was another change of tone.
"Got it! I'm sure I've got it!"
Some of the bigger cylinders were already slowing to a halt. Lobsang was moving pegs around the board now faster than the bewildered Lutzer could follow. And overhead the shutters were slamming back, one after another, showing age-blackened wood instead of colour. No one could be that accurate, could they?
"You're down to months now, lad. Months!" he shouted. "Keep it up!" "No, blimey, you're down to days! Days! Keep an eye on me!"
The sweeper ran towards the end of the hall, to where the procrastinators were smaller. Time was fine-tuned here, on cylinders of chalk and wood and other short-lived materials. To his amazement, some of them were already slowing. He raced down an aisle of oak columns a few feet high, but even the procrastinators that could wind time in hours and minutes were falling silent. There was a squeaking noise. Beside him, one final little chalk cylinder at the end of a row rattled around on its bearing like a spinning top. Lutzer crept towards it, staring at it intently, one hand raised. The squeaking was the only sound now, apart from the occasional clink of cooling bearings.
"Nearly there," he called out. "Slowing down now. Wait for it. Wait for it."
The chalk procrastinator, no bigger than a reel of cotton, slowed, spun, stopped. On the racks, the last two shutters closed. Lutzer's hand fell.
"Now, kill the board! No one touch nothing!"
For a moment, there was dead silence in the hall. The monks watched, holding their breath. This was a timeless moment of perfect balance. And in that timeless moment, the ghost of Mr. Schoblang, to whom the scene was hazy and fuzzy as a thought seen through a gauze, said,
"This is just impossible. Did you see that?"
"See what?" said a dark figure behind him. Schoblang turned.
"Oh," he said, and added with sudden certainty,
"you're death, right?"
"Yes, I am sorry that I am late."
The spirit, formerly known as Schoblang, looked down at the pile of dust that represented his worldly habitation for the previous 600 years.
"So am I," he said.
He nudged Death in the ribs.
"Excuse me."
"I said I'm sorry I'm late. Bada bing, bada boom."
"I beg your pardon."
You know, sorry I'm late. Like, dead."
Death nodded. "Oh. I see. It was the bada-bing, bada-boom I did not understand.
Well, that was to show it was a joke, said Chauvelin.
Ah, yes, I can see how that would be necessary. In fact, Mr. Chauvelin, while you are late, you are also early. Bada bing, bada boom.
Pardon?
You have died before your time.